On July 4th of 1983, a woman named Deborah Manning lost her life in a gruesome murder. Her nude body was found in a ditch with some 30 wounds, most of them stab wounds. She fought her attacker, or attackers. The Debbie Manning case is one we would highlight now and then when I worked for the Southeast Missourian newspaper, but it was a case that just didn't seem to have a lot of leads. Reporters would contact family members, or family members would contact the newspaper, and then we would contact the authorities and get comments and so forth. But those stories were more to put out the word to remind people of this cold murder case. This was pretty standard reporting for cold cases like this. No new leads ever came in, and in this case, no news was bad news. And there hasn't been anything new reported in this case for a long, long time. In this episode of The Lawless Files, we're going to interview a journalist who has taken a much deeper dive into the Debbie Manning murder, who has uncovered new information, and had the rare opportunity to examine the case file of an ongoing, open investigation. This journalist's name is Reagan Ernst. Reagan is a graduate of Southeast Missouri State University who majored in film and TV. She's just a couple of years out of college, but her work on this case demonstrates professional maturity well beyond her years of experience. Reagan is the director and editor of a new documentary-style project on the Debbie Manning case. It's called The Local Whisper. The first episode of the documentary comes out this Friday, October 21st. She's releasing it as an independent project on YouTube, but let me tell you, these episodes are very skillfully and artfully done. In that way, it's as good as shows you'll see on Netflix. Southeast Missouri State University should be proud of the work this alum has done. Reagan is now working as a producer for a television show in Wisconsin. In the background, another person has been working tirelessly on the Manning case, and that's Justin Burns, who has a podcast called Crime Talk Radio, which has highlighted several local cases. The Manning case is especially intriguing to him as he grew up in that general area. He's already put out an episode on the Manning case, and I encourage you to go check it out. He continues to work on the case as well. Debbie Manning was murdered very close to the Scott County and Cape Girardeau County line. It's a case that was botched from the beginning. The sheriff at the time didn't use all of his tools at his disposal, and the murder was just never solved. We don't even know where she was the night of the murder. Several claims that she was at a specific bar before she went missing may or may not be credible. Evidence wasn't very well kept either. The Local Whisper is set to come out this week, so I wanted to interview Reagan and ask her not only about the Manning case, but also some behind-the-scenes things regarding her work. Reagan is a bright young talent, and I want to encourage everyone to check out the documentary when it's released. Reagan puts an emphasis on being respectful of this crime and the family of the victim. Her style is one that avoids sensationalism and simply tells the story. My fingers are crossed, and I know hers are too, that her work, along with Justin's, will help lead to new evidence and charges in this 1983 cold murder case. I'm your host, Bob Miller. You're listening to The Lawless Files.
Instead of just being like, you know, it's 40 years old, let them do their thing, it'll pass. He reached out to me back in May, I believe, and did something I was not expecting at all. He called and said, look, I know you have information that could be useful and could get answers. If you share that with us, you can come down for 1 week, 5 days, and have access to 8 detectives, and they can go and follow any lead that you bring forward.
Okay, Reagan, thank you so much for joining us here on the Lawless Files. We're excited to have you on. You've undergone a huge project here. I know you've had to work on it a long time. I've watched the first 2 episodes. It's very well done. How long have you spent on this project so far?
Thank you. For the whole project, it's probably been about 2 years for me, for this case specifically, a little over a year and a half.
You graduated a couple of years ago from SEMO, right? So you've been working on this project, I guess, you know, since you've been out of college. What drew you to this particular case? We'll get into the case here in a minute, but what drew you to it? How'd you find out about it? What, you know, how'd you get started on it?
Yeah. I, like you said, I went to SEMO, so I kind of knew that area a little bit. And I kind of knew for the first episode, we would want to start in Cape Girardeau. And this is one of, I would say, four major cold cases within Cape Girardeau. So this one stood out to me because of our mission statement. The Local Whispers mission statement kind of centers around cases that weren't given a lot of media attention. In this case in particular, I felt it was given certain pieces, but it was not very descriptive, not very detailed. It never really felt like anyone took the time to really deep dive into it. And so that one kind of stood out to us. And after Justin Burns released his podcast on it, we were excited someone was talking about it. So yeah, we were able to get in contact with him. And from there, it just snowballed.
Okay, great. I wanted to bring Justin up at some point in this interview, so I'm glad you've already done that. But let's talk a little bit about, let's just jump into the case. This is a murder that took place on July 4th, 1983. And we've got a woman that's found on the side of the road. I'm going to let you kind of take it because you've spent so much time on this case. I've watched the episodes, but I've also, I'm familiar with this case having formerly worked at the Southeast Missourian. So I know some of the basics of the case, but I'm going to let you kind of lay the scene of how this crime starts and the discovery that kicks it all off.
So this case was July 4th, 1983, July 4th to July 5th. It's on obviously Deborah Manning. That night she was at her parents' house for fireworks, and around 10:30, she left her parents' residence, was walking home, and that was the last time she was seen alive. And at around 12 to 12:30, she was found on County Road 249 between Cape Girardeau and about Chaffee Delta area.
Yeah, it's right near the county line there, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, it's right on the county line, which is why Scott County Police was called first. And then they realized that it was actually Cape Girardeau Police Department. So they had some jurisdictional issues kind of at the beginning. And from there, it was kept with Cape Girardeau County and was not given to major crimes. Sheriff Bob Gribbler, he chose not to initiate major crimes, which at the time was controversial as well.
Yeah, the major case squad is what you're referring to there, right?
Yes, major case squad, yeah.
Yeah, so major case squad, I think it had been like created, but it hadn't been activated at that point. Again, this is-
That would have been its first case.
Yeah, it would have been the first case, and everybody's kind of kicking themselves now that they didn't enact it, but-
yeah, it's easy to look back and say like, why didn't you do that? But it was the first time. It would have been the first case. Definitely should have been given to the major case squad, but unfortunately it hasn't. And he took it on with his team there.
So Deborah Manning, she was found, I guess, in a ditch with up to 30 stab wounds. Can you tell us a little bit about how she was discovered? About what time frame there, and then kind of what happened in the immediate aftermath of her being discovered.
What's strange about this case is the short time frame. It's pretty unheard of for someone to go missing, be found, killed, and found within 2 hour time frame is what we're talking about. She left at 10:30, she was found at 12:30. So it's a very tight time frame, and she was found brutally murdered, almost 30 stab wounds. They can't define exactly what, because it's at least 30 injuries to her body. Found nude.
You described in the episode that some of them may not have been more scrapes than stab wounds. But she was so brutally, it was just so brutal that you almost lose count of the number of injuries that she had. It was quite horrific. And as you were getting ready to say, she was found nude also. Was there any evidence of sexual assault or anything like that?
So at the time they did a test for sexual assault and it came back inconclusive. They don't believe that she had been raped. It's of the opinion that no matter what happened was because someone was trying to rape her. She has a lot of self-defense wounds, including she broke her fingernails and different details that made it very clear that she put up quite a bit of a fight. So it's believed that whoever this was trying to rape her. She tried to fight back. That is kind of why it escalated to the 20 to 30 stab wounds.
You didn't really talk about this too much in your episode, but the kind of, just playing psychology on a podcast here, and we're not experts here, but you know, you hear about when there's a murder like this, it almost seems like it's personal. With a stabbing rather than a shooting kind of thing. But
it's entirely possible that with it being a knife attack, if they were trying to potentially rape her, and this is all hearsay, I have no idea, but it is understandable that maybe their intention was not to actually attack her. And so that would be why it was a knife attack. But yeah, when you hear 20 to 30 stab wounds, you think that sounds personal. And yeah.
Anyway, that's just kind of conjecture on our part, particularly mine for bringing that up. But can you mention who found her?
Yes. She was found by off-duty officer Richard McCall and his brother. They were driving around country cruising on the 4th of July and came across the body, went to the police, and they came back to the scene and the police took over from there.
Okay. So it's an off-duty police officer from Chaffee, McCall, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Now you'd also mentioned in your episodes that one of the reasons we have a tight timeline is because people were kind of near the scene. They saw some traffic go by. Can you describe that a little bit?
Yes. So there are a lot of details in our episodes that people probably haven't heard at this point because we've been able to do this deeper dive. So a lot of this stuff may be brand new to some people, but yes, there was a couple on the road that night, as well as witnesses in the one home that is on that road. And that kind of led to this tighter timeline of we believe, saw the murder vehicle before Richard and his brother came to the scene.
Yeah.
So that adds this layer to it of complications.
Yeah.
Because of contradicting statements and what was done at the time was, I think that we're all in agreement that what was done at the time was maybe not the best choice for the case. In like interviewing, they did a lot of polygraphs. Their tactic was to just like polygraph most people. And then if they passed a polygraph, that was it. Yeah. That person was written off.
I've seen some of that too. I think back in the 80s and even into the 90s in the case, of the Lawless case, I think oftentimes the polygraph was used. It was trusted more than it is now.
Of course, yeah.
And frankly, kind of misused to eliminate people or to list them as suspects and so forth.
Yeah, I think just like with technology growing, now we know more about polygraphs and the complications of human lie detecting. And so back then it was kind of like black and white. Like this is a tool that makes this entire case. And now we look back and say, well, you know, there's other things that can complicate that.
Miss opportunities also, you know, and let's talk about that a little bit. The sheriff at the time was Gribbler, correct?
Yes.
We talked a little bit earlier about how the major case squad was not activated, but at the same time, in kind of defense of that, there were multiple jurisdictions working on this, this case. But Gribbler was confident that they were going to solve this fairly quickly. And so that kind of ties in with what you were just talking about. Like, it didn't get done that quickly. They didn't do the major case squad. So for those who don't know what the major case squad, it's kind of a unit that was formed through bylaws and so forth that would pull resources in from nearby jurisdictions to kind of put all of their heads together on a detective sense and really hone in on that. But in this case, the major case squad was not called, but Gribbler really thought that he could solve it, especially with the other jurisdictions participating as well. Why do you feel like Gribbler was confident? And secondly, what specific things did he do or not do that might have resulted in a better outcome?
That's a great question. So this is all speculation on my part because Bob Gribbler has passed on. And so unfortunately we couldn't talk to him and get his actual thoughts on this. So all we can do is speculate based on what we have gathered. And based on our interactions, it sounds like it was just an ego issue, unfortunately. It seems that he saw it as an opportunity to solve a murder, have that kind of like under his belt, because he did make a statement at the time that we'll have this solved in 24 hours to the public, to the media. Of course, that didn't happen. Now we're almost 40 years later, and we look back and say, why would you say that? He felt that they had really strong suspects and that he could get it solved in 24 hours. Based on what I know, it sounds like the family members have told me that he has actually come to them before he passed and apologized and said that it was kind of, he was young and he wanted to prove himself. And, you know, he made this public statement and that he was sorry. That is kind of what we understand of the case and why that was handled the way it was. Even at the time, it was pretty controversial. There was a lot of articles out in the Southeast Missourian about this, kind of questioning what his choices, why it wasn't being handed to major crimes, why he was saying it will be solved in 24 hours. I think he was in a lawsuit at the time. I think he had just fired his chief deputy. I'm not totally sure, about a week after this case. There was a lot going on. So even then, he was kind of questioned pretty heavily as to why he did the things that he did. Unfortunately, you can only activate the major crimes unit within, I think it's like the first 48 hours. And so,
yeah,
of course, when... Two days later, you can't do it. So yeah,
it really is a shame. One of the things about your documentary, by the way, it's the photography and the sound and everything was just so great. It's just like, wow. I mean, you're awful young to be putting out something this good. I mean, the quality is just amazing. So I definitely want our listeners to know that this isn't just, you know, someone going around with an iPhone. I mean, this is really professional work. And one of the amazing things about it, not from a video production standpoint, but from a journalism standpoint, is that you were able to kind of find new information and through that information, make connections with the current detectives at Cape Girardeau County and sit in with them and participate in kind of this round robin kind of meeting where you go through all the evidence again. Like, how, for you, like, how did that come about, and how amazing was that as a journalist and as a filmmaker to be able to have that experience?
It was indescribable, really. I mean, my team is amazing. That's the reason that this is the way it is. And part of that includes kind of my, I would say, my tenacity, to kind of hone in on things. And I'm sure I've been quite annoying to the police department.
But if you're not trying hard enough.
Yeah. Luckily, like specifically Chief Deputy, Eric Frederick has been like the most adamant to kind of letting us in, and working together, which we weren't really expecting, you know. With our experience, all of us are filmmakers. Like, this is our side project. This is our little like side project baby. Mm-hmm. But I'm in Madison, Wisconsin. I'm a producer for a TV show up here. And so like coming into these communities, you know, you have to like work a little harder because you're not there. We were expecting them to just be like, who are these people? You know, these documentarians coming in and doing this, but it wasn't really like that with Frederick. Frederick really, after we interviewed him, sat down with him, we asked some questions that I don't think he was expecting. We asked some things that he was kind of like, I'm not sure how you know that. We may have some issues here.
Yeah.
And instead of just being like, you know, it's 40 years old, let them do their thing, it'll pass. He reached out to me back in May, I believe, and did something I was not expecting at all. He called and said, look, I know you have information that could be useful and could get answers. If you share that with us, you can come down for 1 week, 5 days, and have access to 8 detectives, and they can go and follow any lead that you bring forward. And we'll only pay attention to this case for those 5 days, which is pretty unheard of for a case that's almost 40 years old.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
And we got, you know, they gave us full, in trade, they gave us full access to the police files so that I could continue, you know.
That's a journalist's dream right there, you know, to have that kind of access. But then again, like, you know, I would commend them for doing that. It has been 40 years almost.
Yeah.
What do you have to lose at this point?
That's exactly the mentality. Is kind of like, it's an open case. It's always been open. And nothing new has come in about this case.
Yeah.
This particular case, nothing has come in. And so he knew that this was an opportunity to actually like grab and go with, even if it's unorthodox. And that was greatly appreciated.
David James even came out of retirement to join in on the conversations. I thought especially Eric Frederick, and I've met him a time or two. I don't have like a long history with him or anything, but I thought he came off as very sincere and genuine in his interviews, even to the point of saying, yeah, that's not, you know, I mean, he's talking about his jurisdiction, even though he wasn't part of it back then, but acknowledging that, yeah, we should have done some of these things different, or, you know.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of acknowledgement, which we weren't expecting. Kind of coming in, we do cases and people kind of, I would say, underestimate what we are able to bring to the table. And we were anticipating that with this and did not get that. Frederick was, he put aside a lot of that ego and was just like, let's meet in the middle. Come down for a week. You can present everything you found and we'll follow every lead. We'll start over. We're going to re-interview everybody. We're going to like start from scratch, basically.
That's amazing. Did they, were they able to use some of your leads, do you think, or have they talked about that, or?
I think they were. When I came down the first day, I had no idea what to expect. I just brought all of my notes and my interviews and was kind of just like rolling with the punches. And that first day, they brought in the eight detectives and they were all sitting there and kind of staring at me. And then Frederick was like, "Okay, can you break down the case? 'Cause you know this more." And that was such a strange experience because obviously it's a 40-year-old cold case. These detectives now aren't as, they can't be familiar with every cold case and what's going on. They have current cases that they need to worry about. So none of them had really, they knew like very brief details, but none of them really knew.
And so, this is a time for me to kind of defend what it is that we do. And in this kind of genre that we're in, this true crime, we get poked fun at. I mean, I've been doing journalism for, 25 plus years, almost all of that in print. I've just recently got into the podcasting, but there's all sorts of people that poke fun, kind of at, the keyboard detectives or whatever.
Internet sleuths.
But it's kind of the stuff that we're doing that really gives the fresh eyes, and can spend time on it that maybe they can't at.
Exactly. It's something that we should be working together on rather than kind of like constantly poking fun at one another because I understand that the police department has to work on current cases. It's more likely that they're going to solve those. And if they let those go, those are going to end up being a bunch of cold cases that families don't get answers to. So I understand that like they don't have a year and a half to work on one case. That's what we have been doing. And so like it's this kind of equal relationship if they if the police let it be to say like, look, we can't do that. If she brings all of her information that she's looked at for a year and a half, then we can do our thing for 5 days and interview everybody and get further in this. And with this particular case, because of kind of how it was handled in the 80s, a lot of things weren't kept on file. So even if nothing were to come of this, even if they didn't follow any of my leads, I knew I had to do it because at the very least it could get on file. Like right now, it felt like I kept bringing things up and they didn't know what I was talking about.
Oh my.
And you'd be like, and I read the police files and they were so brief that they didn't really go into description about what was said to these people, how the interviews went. And so to get that all on file, to get that, like, okay, well, why was this person eliminated? Because of this, 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 and this. Instead of just saying, we decided that he was not.
Regardless of what happens, the investigation will have been advanced due to this meeting of the minds.
I hope so.
I mean, obviously you spend all this time with the detectives and that's really cool, but you also spend a lot of time with the family members of Debbie Manning. Obviously some emotional interviews in there. What were some kind of big picture takeaways? Obviously they it seems like they're just like they don't have any expectations that this is going to be solved really. Can you just talk about kind of where the family's at right now?
Yes, I just saw the family 2 days ago because they came to the premiere. And that was the most important part to us. The local whisper is not going to come in to cases that don't want us there. I know with these cases, it can bring up a lot of trauma. And for some people who lose that hope, who have lost, like, this is never going to get solved. So why would I put myself through this year after year? That was kind of the back and forth difficulty for them because they weren't really sure whether to trust us or if they wanted to go through all of this again. And we completely understood that and kind of just rode that wave and followed whatever they wanted to do. And
Can you tell us who all you talked to on camera?
on camera, we talked to Deborah's daughter, Amanda Manning. We talked to Deborah's sister and brother, Barb Johnson and Tommy Gaddis. We talked to two of the detectives, Eric Frederick and David James, retired detective. And then through phone calls, we did her, one of her best friends, Carla Ward, and her other son, Brandon Manning.
If you watch the episodes, you know, you kind of get into the suspects and all of that. And I'll just refer my audience, you know, if you want to know about that stuff, to go see the episodes. I would just ask, kind of in a more general sense, how close do you think we are, or the police are, to being able to nail down the suspect and potentially get charges?
For me, it's hard to say. I would say that we've brought forward a strong potential, and they agree that it's a strong potential suspect. Unfortunately, the fact that it's been 40 years complicates things. So we need a fair amount of evidence to prove that and get a warrant in that degree, which is why DNA was resubmitted in 2022 following our investigation, because we were hoping that that DNA will link up to specific people or completely rule them out, and those people can be eliminated officially, because at this point no one has been truly eliminated through DNA. So, you know, we're hopeful that that will at least give some answers.
You put out two episodes here, at least for me to watch. Are you ready to release more? Are there going to be more? Are you going to keep following this? Or, you know, kind of what can we look forward to in terms of your work in this case?
Yeah. So to answer that, kind of like explaining what the Local Whisper is, the Local Whisper is an intention to go into cases that were not covered by the media very much and give a fresh look and an opportunity for families and friends to speak on the victims. Each episode is about the victims, not the killer. That's a very important element for us, because we feel that true crime has really gotten pretty sensationalized, almost like glorifying murder. And that's not to say like to call out any other true crime series or anything like that, but we wanted something that was a little more focused in on the victim. With this particular case, with the Deborah Manning case, the first episode is kind of about Deborah. It starts off as that, and then an overview of the case. And the second episode does delve into, you know, potential suspects, because we were able to uncover information. And, you know, if there's a potential that we could help further the case, we will always try, but it's a case by case basis. So we want to make sure people know that because we worked with the police on this case, it does not mean we're going to work with the police on the next case. Mm-hmm. We will do what we believe is best for the victim and their family and their friends. And if that means working with the police to get answers and potentially get a suspect, then we will do that or try to do that. But that is, we don't want that to be the expectation that.
Yeah, I guess what I was thinking is, I kind of feel like, and I don't have anything to judge us on, we didn't really talk about this at all, but I kind of feel like, well, I just know it from my own perspective. Like, you have more information than what you're able to publish. And so I'm kind of just wondering if you're hanging on to some stuff, and later on, if there's charges that you'll release more.
We would love to. Like you said, the Local Whisper it's a pretty highly produced show. It's very expensive. And we all do this on our free time. We all have full-time jobs on our own shows. And so it requires a certain level of production value that we would like to maintain. But obviously that's going to cost more money. So we would be happy to release more information. It may be through a different platform if that is the case. If, you know, things start moving and things start coming out about the DNA or about people who have been interviewed or whatever, we may hop on a podcast and just kind of talk through what was left out of the documentary, because we have, I mean,
yeah,
people need to know that like a documentary or docuseries, there's about, if you're 100% of your footage, you use about 25%.
Yeah.
Especially with us going down for 5 whole days to work with the police department, we have hours and hours of footage that didn't make it into the docuseries because we are pretty particular with journalistic integrity and making sure we don't post anything that could make things worse for the case. That's never our intention. And so we don't want to put out something that we don't know for a fact is like, not even a fact, but as far as we understand, it is something that we are able to prove. It is something that, you know, this person said this and this person said this, and here's our follow to that. If there are things that kind of come out as time is going on and we have things that might back that, we would be happy to release it. But at this point, we don't want to like point fingers at anyone or make situations worse when we don't have the backing.
Yeah, no, I get that. I definitely
understand. You have to be very careful. It's not something like we are very, very careful about what we put out and what we keep to ourselves, not because we want to hide anything, but because you're talking about people's lives, you know, especially it being 40 years later, the person who likely did this could be passed on there, or they're 60 or 70 years old. And you really want to make sure you have done the best you can to get the right information and try not to be biased in any way. Because it would be terrible to point fingers at someone who isn't alive anymore and can't defend themselves, or is, you know, 70 years old, retired, and trying to just stay under the radar. It's something that just requires a lot of care, and we've been very much trying to maintain that care throughout the Local Whisper.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
All right. So, Reagan, can you talk about any other cases that you're working on? I'm guessing nothing. You kind of mentioned earlier you want to start in Cape Girardeau. I'm assuming that you've got some other projects in the works that probably aren't from around here, but I'm still interested in what your plans are next.
Yes. So we plan to release, the first episode of The Local Whisper comes out October 21st, and then the second episode comes out November 4th. After that, we kind of want to see the public reaction and whether or not, you know, people want more. Our team loves this project and would love to do more, but it's a very expensive project. So we have ones that are kind of on the back burner in our minds, cases, and we want to leave the Missouri area, try different cases all over, because there are so many cases that have not been given the proper attention. So got probably about 10 cases in our backlog that we're looking at.
It becomes a little overwhelming, doesn't it? Like when people start reaching out to you,
yes.
Like, you know, me doing the Lawless case, I didn't know really what I was going to do after that. And just people are coming forward and saying, hey, can you please look into mine? Can you please, you're going to get a lot of that. And it's really hard. In fact, when I was doing the Lawless case, I too met Justin and I learned that he was looking at some other cases. So I didn't want to really, you know, jump on but the Manning case, you know, there's a lot even here in the Scott County area, you know, Cape Girardeau area. You just can't do it all. Like once you do that deep dive, it's like, it's just really hard to juggle more than one at a time.
Yeah. There are people who have reached out about either Scott County cases or Cape Girardeau County cases. And while we would love to work on a lot of cases, I think this is where the local whisper can differ from like something like Crime Talk Radio. They both serve different purposes. Mm-hmm. Justin serves this purpose of trying to get a wide range of cases viewed, and that's needed. For us, we spend a year and a half on one case. We don't have the capability. It's more picking certain cases and giving it all of our energy and all of our time and all of our effort. And so we can't do 10 different cases. Otherwise we would be.
Yeah. And I just wanted to plug Justin and Crime Talk Radio a bit. You know, you mentioned that, and we both know Justin, and again, he has this podcast, Crime Talk Radio, and he works really hard on the cases that he does put out there. He's got his heart is in it. It's just he does a different thing than what, you know, what you do, certainly what I did with at least the first season. The issue just from a sustainability standpoint is, it took me four years to fully investigate the law. You know, you don't want to just do something every 4 years, you know? So, you know, I've kind of been looking at cases in the Fredericktown, Madison County area. It's wild and crazy. Wild West over there, but so I'm kind of a hybrid, you know, but this work is really hard, and this would be a good opportunity too to kind of talk a little bit more about your work. The imagery for the case, kind of what was your thought process going in? It was really cool to kind of see like these images of the research. I found that really cool. But when you're looking at a case like this, you got to figure out B-roll, because there's not a lot of images of the stuff that you're talking about. Obviously you're going to have faces of people you're interviewing, but just kind of talk about as you're strategizing and how to figure out how to visualize this thing, where'd you start from, and talk about the execution of it and your team.
You're hitting it right on the nail. There's a lot I want to say, like all of it. I know that the visual side of things is, you know, obviously we want attention to the case, and that needs to be backed up by visuals that represent it. And this is a 40-year-old cold case. We don't have many photos. We don't have video of anything that took place or anything like that. And so we have to supplement all of this and think through our B-roll. And I have to speak very highly about my team, because would not be possible without my team. And that would be kind of the core team. Was Avanna Malia is my executive producer. Joe Willenbrink and Taylor Bevert are my two DPs, directors of photography. Without that core team, the four of us, it could not have been possible. Having two directors of photography in particular was important to this, because it took a lot of thought. People don't realize when we came together for the Local Whisper, before we even talked about Deborah Manning, we had meetings on meetings of the look and the feel and what we wanted. And we were very particular about kind of what we were looking for. And, you know, we've said it before, but if anyone has seen the movie Spotlight, it's done on, yes, I love Spotlight. Mm-hmm. I kind of brought that to Taylor and Joe and was like, this is what I want. Cause we all three loved that film and how it was done. It really showcased the research side of things, which to a lot of people, that can be the most boring side of things.
Yeah.
But as you and I know, that's 90% of what you do.
Yeah.
And so we wanted to make it very research heavy, and it can be hard to do that with keeping it interesting.
I'm not a film expert. That's not my background. But as someone who's watched a fair amount of documentaries and stuff, I just thought the imagery along with the music just really had like a very methodical feel to it. like a very serious, you know, this isn't car chases and explosions. This is very methodical. It's very serious. We're taking you through this journey and we're being respectful with the information and with the families. That all comes across, not just in the what you're saying and presenting, but also through the music and the images. So if that was your goal, it's very well accomplished.
As the editor also on this project, it's been followed through from beginning to end. Everything has been thought through. Music was chosen before, in pre-production, we chose music before we filmed anything. So we've kind of created this identity and this brand. It, I think, allows us to do cases like this because we've got kind of one of the family members, Amanda Manning, watched it and said, what I loved about the first one is how it kind of felt like a dream. Like, we didn't mimic anything. We weren't doing like shot for shot, kind of imitating what happened, because we felt that that was kind of dramatizing it and not making it real. Instead, we included a lot of imagery of this empty road and this quiet town and this, like, these little detail shots, a sign.
The drone footage was very helpful. Yes. And you know, some of the, where you put the text overlaid, where places were, was really good visual storytelling as well, just to help the viewer understand kind of where things are. So very well done. You know, you had mentioned kind of before the nature of true crime. And I just did a podcast where I kind of got into that, got on a soapbox a little bit. So, you know, I feel like I owe it to my audience to only recommend those things that do take victims seriously, that do take this work very seriously. And I highly recommend anyone to check out the work that you've done. So can you share with us how they can find it once again and how they can help and share and, you know, get the word out for you as well?
Yeah. If this is something that people are interested in, we truly can't express how important it is to go to our social media. We are at The Local Whisper on everything. Facebook, Instagram, YouTube. Follow us in all those places, share our posts, like things. It means the world to us. We manage it ourselves every day. We check and see every comment. We comment back, and it allows us to continue this. So if it's something that you particularly are like, wow, that's a cool thing, the more you involve in our social media, the more we can actually do this to continue doing more cases. Just go to The Local Whisper, Google it, and get onto any of our social media.
It'll be on YouTube. When? What day again?
Episode 1 will release Friday, Friday, October 21st. Okay. And then the second episode will release November 4th.
Okay.
So 2 Fridays after that.
All right. So as an independent creator myself, I know so much of this is done just out of pure passion. You know, you want to use your talents in such a way that helps these cases. So I would encourage everybody out there to go support another independent creator who's put herself out on the line and done all of this work. Go support her and let's blow this thing up so the world can be familiar with The Local Whisper. So Reagan, is there anything else that you want to say?
Just thank you. It's really nice that kind of like everyone who has reached out in the Cape Girardeau area, you, Justin, it feels like a really tight-knit community. And I've always been like welcomed in with open arms within kind of the people who have worked on this case or have worked on other cases in this area. And we really appreciate it. When I called you back when we were in pre-production, you were so helpful and honest and
well, provided. I'm willing to talk about public records requests to anybody.
Yeah, I was like, I gotta talk to the Vital Bureau, the Bureau of Vital Records. I was so determined because there's a grand jury file, and I was like, how do I get a hold of this?
No, good luck with that. That's a tough lock to crack right there. So
absolutely. And yeah. So it's been a very positive experience to see people come together in this way. A lot of people could be very closed off from other people kind of coming in. And we have really haven't experienced that with this case and with this town, this area. And we really appreciate it, you know, letting us.
All right. It's our pleasure to try to lift you up if we can and, you know, keep doing great work. Good luck with you and this project and your professional work in Wisconsin, all that stuff. And let your team know, we said hello. And good luck to all you guys. I hope this is something that blows up and you guys can continue this work for as long as you want to.
Thank you. We're all Lawless Files fans, so I hope this continues and we see more on your side of things. But
okay. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Reagan. Good luck to you. Have a great week.
All right. You too.
All right. Bye.
Thank you for listening to The Lawless Files. I'm your host, Bob Miller. If you'd like to support The Lawless Files and the work we do here, please go to www.thelawlessfiles.com and sign up for a guest access pass. For $36, you get 1 year of access to ad-free listening, occasional early bird episode listening, and extra bonus materials. For example, just last week we put out a blog about results from the Sunshine Law request that we issued to Madison County. So you can get things like that with your access pass. Again, that's www.thelawlessfiles.com. The Lawless Files is a production of Lead Hound Publishing, LLC. Music by Tyler Grafe.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.